There are four women named in the genealogy of Christ in the first chapter of Matthew. And if you haven't read that genealogy with that thought in mind, I doubt seriously whether you could guess very many of those women. You don't have Sarah or Rebecca or Rachel here, but the four women are Tamar in verse 3, who was the daughter-in-law of Judah, who sat like a harlot by the side of the road and seduced her own father-in-law. Rahab, the harlot of Jericho. Ruth, the despised Moabitess. And Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. That's rather a strange thing to me, that four women would be chosen to be named in the genealogy of Christ, and they would be four women that either were associated with wickedness or, in Ruth's case, came from a very strange background to be a part of this genealogy. I don't know the reasons. I suppose that it's one way of saying that Christ came to save all people. Regardless of the depths to which one has gone, the salvation is still offered. It is unusual that in impressing womanhood upon us, the characters for whom God had done so much are the ones that are pulled out and named. But that's what occurs. Or another strange thing is to look at the number of temptresses in the Bible. Women who are famous because they were outstandingly tempting to men. You'd think immediately of Jezebel. If you read all those details carefully, it was very hard to find some men who would fling her out when the time came for her to be punished. She seems to have had quite a way of enticing not only Ahab, but a good many other people around her. Or you'd think of Salome, who danced, and Herod was so pleased that he was willing to cut off John Baptist's head and give it to her mother on a platter. Or you'd think of Delilah. You just have to. I suppose that the attraction Hollywood has had for these women would be reminders enough that they are the temptresses of the Bible. But Delilah is perhaps the greatest of them all. She's at least the best known. And her name has become a kind of synonym for deceiving people, or for the woman who doesn't really respect principle, but only desires to get her man by whatever means. When I told the story of Hannah, it was rather hard to avoid preaching a sermon on Samuel, because Hannah's real importance is that she gave the world a man who became a great judge and the precursor of the kings. When I talked about Abigail, it was awfully difficult to avoid preaching a sermon on David, because Abigail's greatness we would not have known had it not been for her contact with David, the king. The same thing is true with Bathsheba, and we've dealt with her in the Sunday morning sermon indirectly, because it was a sermon on David. And Bathsheba's importance comes as she has the interplay with him. The same thing is true of Delilah. It's difficult to talk about Delilah without it seeming that we're going to talk about Samson. But the greatness of the woman, used in a very evil fashion, does come through looking at the greatness of the man and the fact that she was his ruin. You'll recall the period of the judges in a general way. When during the period that the last verse of the book describes as a time when every man did what was right in his own eyes because there was no king in Israel, when violence was so prevalent on every hand, there was a real need for some kind of strong leadership. During that period, there was a man named Manoah who, along with his wife, lived a very godly life. And one day, an angel appeared to Manoah's wife and began to tell her that she was going to have a child. She should not drink any wine or strong drink. She should not eat any unclean thing. Even the prenatal influence of the child is taken into consideration by the angel, because you're going to have a child. If you recall the story from Judges 13, when she told Manoah that she was going to have a child, Manoah began to have a great many questions. And he prayed to God to send the same messenger back who had come to his wife, and God granted the request. When the messenger came back, Manoah made a request from him that he would tell him how to rear the child. It's one of the most beautiful prayers in the Bible about rearing children. Oh Lord, I pray thee, let the man of God whom thou didst send come again to us and teach us what we are to do with the boy that shall be born. And a little later, Manoah said, when the angel had come, and when your words come true, what is to be the boy's manner of life? What is he to do? It was an unusual thing. It was a supernatural circumstance that surrounds his birth, as surely as one surrounded the birth of Isaac when Sarah bore him out of years, or as the events that surrounded the birth of John the Baptist when Elizabeth gave birth to him when she'd passed her normal period of childbearing. Same kind of circumstance accompanies the birth of Samson. And Manoah prays, what kind of boy is he going to be? What's he supposed to do with his life? How shall we order the child? When the angel responded, he told Manoah and his wife that the boy should be a Nazarite. A razor should never touch his head. He should never taste any wine or strong drink. He should never eat anything unclean. It's a little bit surprising to me again that in biblical times, God so often required a great man to be what we would call a total abstainer. John the Baptist has these same characteristics, as does Samson. It goes with the Nazarite vow, which was God's special way of making Samson the great man he became. Samson grew up in that kind of home with a good many advantages, with parents who cared, who'd been well prepared, and again, strangely enough, when God wanted a great man, he usually went about preparing the parents well in advance of the birth of that great man. When Samson grew toward adulthood, he began to discover that he had great power, strength. His parents called him Samson, which means sunny. I suppose we could say sunshine and get very close to it. And again, we don't know why. Maybe he had a ruddy complexion. Maybe he was born with blonde, sunny-like hair. Maybe they had a kind of premonition about the sort of disposition he would have as a sunny personality. But for some reason, they named him Sunshine or Sunny. The power that he began to exert was striking to everybody around him. He'd take these brief escapades over among the Philistines, the enemies of Israel, and come back only to be rebuked by his fellows for what he had done, because that's going to set up a war between us and them. And yet the Bible clearly indicates that God caused one or two of these incidents to occur in order to arouse Samson to deliver Israel from the Philistines. 40 years they'd been slaves, and the Philistines really knew how to make people slaves. In 1 Samuel 13, chapter verses 20 and 21, during the period of Samuel's rulership, we're told that the Israelites had to go to the Philistines even when they sharpened their tools. An axe, a plow, an instrument with which to reap their crops, and they could not have any sword of any sort. The Philistines kept all the grinding, sharpening instruments, and that way they knew the Israelites weren't going to come up with a bunch of spears with which they could fight. With this kind of slave imposition of their will on the Israelites, 40 years they'd held Israel down. And the angel told Manoah and his wife that Samson would begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Because of the way his life turned out, that's all he did. He just began. But he did enough that the writer of Hebrews in chapter 11, verse 32, listed Samson along with his heroes of faith. I don't know if I would have done that or not. But perhaps in the light of the way he died, I would have. But he does. A list of men that he says of whom the world was not worthy. Samson not only had his greatness, though, he had his weaknesses. He was quite a jokester. One day when he was very upset, his father-in-law, the first woman he married, had given Samson's wife to his companion, who'd been his best man in the wedding, apparently. Samson grew so angry when he got over his fit of anger with her for having given away his riddle and went back over to see her, found that she was already married to somebody else. He grew so angry that he went out and got several hundred foxes together, tied their tails together and put a torch between each one's, or between the tails of each pair, and turned them loose to go among the grain fields. They set fire to the fields and to the shocks of the Philistines, destroying much of their crops. Samson could have done a much more effective job, or could have done it more quickly by himself with his own hand, and he could catch all those foxes and prepare all those torches. But he was quite a prankster. On another occasion, when he got very angry with the Philistines, in fact, after he'd gone over and done this act, 3,000 of his brethren came down to him and begged him, don't go do this again. Don't you know what you're doing to us? You're getting us in a war with people that we aren't equipped to fight. Samson agreed with him, I'll let you bind me and take me and deliver me to the Philistines if you won't fall on me. And they promised. And so he was bound. And when they delivered him to the Philistines, he broke the cords as if they'd been threads. grabbed himself a fresh jawbone of an ass and immediately killed 1,000 men among the Philistines. His power, each time it said the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and the power of the man has to be seen in terms of God supernaturally helping the man to accomplish what he set out to accomplish. But also the prankish nature of what he did is rather obvious. Second woman that he was affiliated with was a harlot down at Gaza. Men of Gaza decided that they would lie in wait for him. Next morning when it was daylight, they'd kill him. He woke up at midnight, went to the gates of the city, and they were closed. He was ready to leave, didn't want to risk his life. He pulled up the gates of the city, took them up to the top of the hill, and deposited them. And there's again a sense of humor in what he does as he goes about exerting a fantastic strength. But Samson's weakness comes at the point of his jokester nature as well, because doing something for a joke when he might have done something much more effective in terms of leadership seems to have made him a less effective judge. He was the only bulwark Israel had against the Philistines in what I've described as a very violent time. So violent that, for example, a little while later in the book of Judges, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, or a man came through the tribe of Benjamin through one of their villages with a concubine he had. Some men in a village of the Benjamin tribe took that concubine and abused her all through the night. The next morning she was lying dead on the doorstep. Terrible wickedness such as one would find in Sodom. And he cut her body into 12 parts and sent one part to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. They got their men of war together and virtually wiped the tribe of Benjamin off the map. One of their own tribes. It was an extremely violent time. And Samson is about the only shadow strength there is in this period. And he's quite a prankster. The other weakness Samson had is suggested by Delilah. He had a weakness for women. The first woman he loved was a Philistine. His mother and father, who'd been so concerned about him from before his birth, were told when he came home that he'd found her and she pleases me right well. Get her for me. They said, isn't there a woman among all our own people that you have to go over to this uncircumcised Philistine group and get your wife? But that's when we're told that God intended to use this incident through which to stir up Samson. Samson, you remember, as he was going on his way to get his wife, met a lion. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. He tore that lion apart as if it had been a lamb. Left the carcass lying by the side of the road. The next time he went down that way, bees had swarmed. There was all sorts of honey. He reached in and got himself a handful, gave some of it to his parents, but didn't tell them where it came from. Then devised a riddle for a little game during his several days' wedding feast celebration. When he told the riddle to the people, he said, I'll wager you 30 changes of raiment that you can't figure out this riddle. And they agreed. The riddle was, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. They worked with it for about 3 days, couldn't do any good, went to his wife and said, you've got to find out, because instead of us celebrating your wedding, we're going to be impoverished. We've got to give this fellow 30 expensive changes of raiment. She went to work with Samson, couldn't do any good at first. Then she used what women sometimes use. She cried 7 days. And through that, she got to his heart. He told her where the strength or where the honey had come from. And when they came back, the men, they said, what is sweeter than honey? What's stronger than a lion? And that's when Samson said, if you'd not plowed with my heifer, he wouldn't have found out my riddle. But it wasn't very long until he forgot the lesson he'd learned. He turned into the harlot in Gaza, just a plain harlot. Again, it proved to be a very unhappy experience for Samson, and finally sent him out pulling up those gates of the city to save his own life. And then woman number three was Delilah. She dwelt in the valley of Sorek 10 years ago when I was in Israel. On the little road from Jerusalem over to Caesarea, there was a service station that interested me. It was called Samson's Inn. Painted very simply, but we did, sure enough, begin to tour that valley all around it. And there were signs that are erected significantly in English rather than Hebrew, because most of the tourists speak English, with sections of the book of Judges engraved on the sides of the signs. Here is where Samson did this, or here is where David fought Goliath. It's a rather beautiful area of an otherwise somewhat deserted or desert land. It's being brought back out in its ancient beauty a great deal today, at least apart from wartime it is. But Delilah lived in this beautiful valley. Whether she was a harlot by trade or whether she simply succumbed to the temptation for a great amount of money, when Samson fell in love with her, he met his final ruin. You remember the story. The men of the Philistines, the leaders, had tried so many ways to deal with Samson. They'd been unsuccessful, and so they came to her and said, "We'll give you 1,100 pieces of silver if you'll deliver him into our hands. Find the secret of his strength so we can overcome him." I don't know how much a shekel of silver is worth. A recent commentary says 60 to 65 cents. If that was true when that commentary was printed 10 years ago, it ought to be worth a dollar or so by now, and you see the difficulty. But they offered her 1,100 pieces of silver. It was enough money that she gave in. And you begin to get a sketch of Delilah's character. A woman of great physical beauty, but a woman of ambition. A selfish woman who's willing to do whatever is necessary to get gain for herself. A woman who is false to the core, who will do anything to get the secret out of Samson. And a woman, finally, who will use her love for an inferior or ulterior purpose. I think when you put those characteristics together, you describe a type of woman still very much alive. One only has to walk through the streets of any of our large cities, including Memphis, to learn very quickly that this type of woman has not perished from the earth. There are still Abigails and Hannahs and Ruths, but there are still women who use beauty as a means of satisfying selfish ambition. And the proverb is still true. A man can't take fire into his bosom without being burned. He can't walk on hot coals without being scorched. But young men still forget Proverbs 6, and sometimes older men take the fire into the bosom and the home life is destroyed. If we had any way of knowing the reasons for the broken homes and the ripped apart lives of people in our time, Delilah would be at the heart of a heavy percentage of those. If we had any way of knowing the reason for the vast alcohol consumption in our country, a great deal of it would be associated with the kind of thing Delilah was offering as an enticement to Samson. Samson succumbed. Delilah would beg him, "Tell me where your strength lies." He would lie to her. That was his start away from the God to whom he'd made the Nazarite vow. And he said, "If I'm ever bound with 7 green bowstrings, I can't break them. Men can do anything to me." She bound him just this once more. And with his hands fixed to the pillars, and I wondered, was Delilah on that roof with those 3,000 people, laughing, feasting? Was Milton wrong and she in the midst? He gave all his strength and asked God to allow him to die in the process. The pillars moved and the house collapsed. That's not really a Christian story. One doesn't find many of the characteristics of Christ in a man like Samson. And yet there is something noble about being willing to die for a cause. And Samson is now ready. He ends with a burst of final devotion. The people who plagued God's people for so long are punished, more of them in his death than had been in his life. But Delilah has proved to be the great temptress. She's ruined a holy man. A man who judged Israel 20 years. A man of unparalleled strength, physically speaking. But he fell because a woman was false, used her beauty for selfish ends, was willing to use love, the tenderest of her gifts, for personal gain. She's become a synonym for deceit and a reminder to every young man who's looking for a wife. The thing you're looking most for is not physical beauty. The thing that will ensure your marriage, its happiness, the happiness of your children and your grandchildren, is to find character. If you can't have absolute trust in that marriage, it'll be miserable. But if you find character, If you find a good woman in Proverbs 31, everything else will be secondary, and the home can be happy. Without it, physical beauty will not only fade, it can be very bitter before it fades. Delilah, the reminder of a certain kind of character not to be, and an encouragement toward a true spirit in the love relationship. If there's someone who needs to give his or her life to God, would you, tonight while we sing?
Oh,